he said thoughtfully, but doesn't take away from my earlier observation that it sucks to be you. I had to drive back to the interstate and over the Blue Bridge to get home. It added 15 or 20 minutes to the trip. Having the cable bridge down was going to get old really fast. My phone rang through the stereo system, an unfamiliar number. It wasn't my car, and my purse with my phone in it was tucked under my seat. And then Sherwood helpfully hit the answer button on the stereo's touchscreen. I think he thought I was having trouble reaching it. Any number not in my contacts list, I usually let leave a voicemail. It saved me from the guilt of hanging up on someone trying to sell me auto warranties on cars I didn't own. "Mercy," I said.
"Stay away."
"Pastor," I said. "Pastor White, is that you?" He cried out, and the connection was reset. I turned on my turn signal, hit the gas, and headed to church. Maybe they were at Pastor White's house, but I didn't know where he lived. The best I could do was the church.
"What's up?" asked Sherwood.
"That's my pastor," I told him. Pastor White was new. Our last pastor had left to take over his father's church in California. Pastor White wasn't quite as engaging or accepting, but his faith was real. "Somebody wants me to go to church," I said. I hit a button on the stereo and said, "Call Adam." Sherwood and I listened to his phone ring. When the voicemail picked up, I said, "Someone attacked slash kidnapped my pastor, and I'm heading to the church right now. It is 11:54. I disconnected. Whom to call? Ben and Paul were home with Jesse and Aiden. "Call Honey," I said, and got her answering machine. I didn't leave a message. "Call George," another answering machine. I pounded a fist on the steering wheel. What the heck good does it do me to be a PAC member when there's never anyone home?
"I do not understand what the heck good," said the stereo. "Please say a command. Some commands you might find useful are call or search address book."
I growled, then said, "Call Mary Jo." She picked up immediately.
"Hey, Mercy," she said, her voice wary.
"I need you to gather anyone you can find who is not guarding the house," I told her, "and bring them to the Good Shepherd on Bonnie." I gave her terse directions because it was hard to find, even with the address.
"Got it," she said.
I hit the end call button and settled in to drive.
"I'm not much good in a fight," said Sherwood tightly. "My leg."
"You can pick up a 300-pound bar of steel. You can fight," I told him, not looking away from the road. I was driving too fast, and I didn't want to hit anyone. There was a pause.
"I guess that is so," he said, like it was a revelation. "Okay."
The church was small. It had been a house that someone converted into a church about 20 years ago. It was tucked unobtrusively into the most maze-like section of Kennewick, a little residential area on the north side of the railroad that ran along the Columbia. There were only two ways in or out, one on the far east side, one on the west. The east side entrance was the easiest to navigate. The church grounds backed up to the railway, and between a couple of empty lots and the parking lot, it was half a block from the nearest house. There were two cars in the lot parked next to the handicap parking. One of them was Pastor White's. The other was a Ford Explorer that had seen better days. I parked Adam's SUV on the side of the lot farthest from the cars in the church building. I gathered the SIG's two spare magazines from my purse and stuck them in the back of my waistband because my stupid jeans didn't have pockets. Sherwood scrounged around and came up with a tire iron. I shook my head at him, opened the rear hatch, and pushed back the mat to expose the big locked box. My handprint released the lock. I opened the box and revealed Adam's new treasure chest. Inside was a collection of guns and various bladed weapons.
"Any idea of what we're facing?" Sherwood asked, examining the contents of the box.
I shook my head. "Probably Fay, but it could be one of the anti-supernatural groups or Cantrip or anyone. If they are here in the church, it probably won't be vampires." Sherwood had spent a few years in the Marox pack. He'd know how to fight whatever we'd face as well as I did. "If you figure it out first, let me know." He picked up an axe and checked it for balance.
"This works for the Fey," he said.
Then he picked up the HK-45 compact, checked it,
It was loaded.
This will do for anything else.
He decocked it and put it in the pocket of his jeans. Compact was an optimistic label for that gun.
That's a dangerous place to carry it, I told him. He grinned at me. Nah, that's my bum leg. Can't shoot my foot off 'cause someone already did that. What does the interior look like?
The church was a house once upon a time, I told him. Then I described it the best I could. We paused for a moment by the cars. By now, the scent of Fey magic lingered in the air, so I was pretty sure that was whom we were facing. However, the Ford Explorer belonged to a human male who did a lot of smoking.
Do you recognize him? Asked Sherwood in a voice that wouldn't carry.
I shook my head, but the church wasn't empty during the week. I was grateful that it wasn't a Tuesday when the choir practiced, or Thursday when the youth group met to plan their monthly community service. On other days...
The pastor has a degree in sociology, I told him softly. He makes most of his living as a counselor for recovering addicts.
Not a lot of money in that, Sherwood observed.
He was looking around alertly. The conversation was to keep relaxed and ready. It wasn't how I functioned, but I'd fought side by side with enough people, mostly wolves, to know that it was a technique that worked for some people.
I said, not a lot of money being a pastor of a small non-denominational church either. I expect that if he wanted to be rich, he'd have gone into a different business.
Does this change our strategy? Sherwood asked, patting the car soundlessly.
He was acting as if I knew what I was doing.
I don't think so, right? I said. Two hostages, or two victims if the Fae have already killed them.
The humans aren't dead, said Z, startling a squeak out of me and an annoyed look out of Sherwood. I was alerted that something was planned, and apparently my information was correct.
Where did you come from? I asked him.
He frowned at me.
Where your enemy might be next time.
Nah, said Sherwood. He was waiting around the corner of the building, Mercy. Downwind, but I caught a glimpse of him when you parked. I figured he'd been waiting for us. If he'd been the enemy, I'd have said something. I didn't see him approach, though.
Do you know who they are? I asked C. What do they want?
9 or 10 idiots who follow a greater one, Z answered. These are the ones who left a letter on Christie's front door. According to my source and Adam's telephone conversation, they want Aiden.
I frowned. I can scent at least 3, one of whom I knew.
4, said Sherwood. One of them is flying, but I caught something where it landed on the top of the car.
Z considered the church. The lights in the upstairs rooms were on, but the windows had all been replaced with stained glass. It was impossible to see inside.
The humans are upstairs with Uncle Mike, Z said, confirming my nose. I heard them set him to watch.
Is he the one who told you about this? I asked.
Probably, Z said. I can't imagine that he'd be this stupid unless he's working as a spy for the Council.
What's stupid about it? Asked Sherwood. They take hostages Mercy cares about to get an unlikable ancient in the shape of a boy who is doing his best to burn down Mercy's home.
Trade the hostages for the boy, and it's win-win for all.
The dry dislike in Sherwood's voice told me that he'd had an unpleasant encounter with our Aiden. Aiden was prickly and very good at getting under people's skin when he wanted to. If I hadn't seen him vulnerable, hadn't heard his nightmares, maybe I would be more ambivalent about him, too.
Z snorted. Only if you don't know Mercy or Adam, or anyone else involved. As if either of our idiot heroes would ever turn someone who looks as helpless as Aiden over to the Fae.
Hey, I protested softly. I'm not an idiot or a hero, but he had the last part right. By mutual consent, we left the Explorer and headed into the church. The front porch had been modified with a wheelchair ramp next to the stairs, and both led to a double-door entryway that wasn't original to the house. The changes had been made with an eye to economy rather than harmony. We could wait for reinforcements, but if the Fae thought themselves outgunned, they were likely to kill and run. We had a better chance going in now and hoping the cavalry made it in time to help with the cleanup.
Mercy,
said Z in a nearly soundless voice that was hard for me to hear even with my ears, and I stood 2 feet away.
You go upstairs with your werewolf. Wolf,
Z met Sherwood's eyes and didn't look away.
You keep her alive. I think that it's only Uncle Mike up there with the human hostages, and I think that he'll let you get them free.
Meanwhile, asked Sherwood in the same very quiet tone. Z smiled wickedly and snapped his hand down, where a narrow, black-bladed sword appeared.
I'll keep the others occupied.
Z, I said, are you okay to fight? He still wasn't moving right. Z nodded.
Against these fools, I could fight them off if I were blindfolded and tied hand and foot.
I let it go, though I was still worried. The Fae speak the truth, as they know it. Just because Z was an arrogant old Fae didn't make him right. We walked up to the doors with me in front and the others flanking me. I pulled the right-hand door open, and Sherwood reached around me to pull the left so we could enter as one group. The entryway was a 20-by-10 room cut off from the rest of the church by a wall with a walkway on either side. There was a kitchenette to our left with a refrigerator, a sink, and a stove. The interior wall had a counter and a half-wall that opened into the main room with a curtain that could be shut or open. It was shut. On the right was the stairway that led up to the pastor's office, three rooms that were set up as classrooms, and the bathroom. Z slipped around the wall and into the sanctuary that encompassed the rest of the first floor. Sherwood and I, in that order, headed up the stairs. Below us in the sanctuary there was a huge crash, a wary cry followed by the clashing sounds of weaponry engaging. The top of the stairway led to a hall with five closed doors. The door to the immediate right of the stairs was the pastor's office. To the left was the bathroom. Then there were the three classrooms, one left, one right, and one at the end of the hall. My sense of smell was of limited use for finding Pastor White. His scent was everywhere. The man who'd driven the Explorer was better. He'd gone into the pastor's office, but I caught his scent farther down the hall, where he'd have no reason to go. I tapped my nose and pointed at the classroom door at the end of the hall. Sherwood nodded as a huge crash below us spelled the end of one of the stained glass windows. My fault. The Fae had only come here because of me. Sherwood took point, the axe in one hand and the big gun in the other. I reached past him to turn the knob, and he elbowed the door in. The classroom was the largest of the five upstairs rooms. The pastor and a stranger were tied to folding chairs, gagged with duct tape. The floor of the room was covered in a dark brown carpet that showed the triple ring of salt someone had placed around them. Between them and us stood Uncle Mike, a crossbow in his hand. He brought it up, but let the nose point down to the floor as soon as he saw it was me. There were three containers of Morton salt. Two of them were open, but the third still had a seal on the spout.
"Shut that door," he said. "There's a sprite lord out there, and I don't want his sprite seeing what I have done until Z's through with them, stupid louts."
"What's this about?" I asked.
"I can't tell you," he said. "All I can tell you is they gave me my orders to bring these two upstairs and secure them." He grinned fiercely. "My orders didn't say secure them from whom. As long as those idiots," he paused as the whole building vibrated, "don't burn the place down, your pastor and this gentleman are safe from most of my kind." "Who did you bring with you?" he asked. "Is it Z?"
"Can't you get across the salt?" I asked. He shook his head.
"This isn't just salt, but salt bonded with magic. I've locked out most Fae, including myself. Z might manage it. One or two of the Grey Lords. But the only one of this group, the one who gave me my orders and is powerful enough to break this, isn't here."
He stared hard at me. There was something he couldn't tell me. He'd said he couldn't tell me why they were here. I thought it was obvious. But if it were obvious, Uncle Mike wouldn't have bothered to talk to me about it. What did they gain from their actions so far? Two hostages. But they were human hostages near enough to me that I'd respond. But, as Z pointed out, if they knew anything about Adam or me, they'd never believe that we'd turn Aiden over to them. So what had they gained? They'd called me, let the pastor talk until they were sure I knew who he was, and hung up. And I'd come right over, hadn't I? I pulled out my cell and called Mary Jo. "We're on our," she answered. "No. Go to the pack house," I said. "There are some Fae coming for Aiden." Uncle Mike smiled. I called the house, but no one picked up.
I called Jessie, and it went to her voicemail. I called Warren, Daryl, Ben, and George with the same results. I called Adam.
Not a good time, Mercy, he said tightly.
Don't hang up, I told him. Did you listen to my message?
No, I'm discussing bugs with Cantrip.
He would have said more, but I interrupted him. The Fae are attacking our home, I said. Don't listen to my message, waste of time. Don't worry about me. Worry about Jessie, about Aiden, and our wolves. There's a Fae attack at the house, I repeated, and no one is answering their phones.
Headed home, he said, and hung up.
Uncle Mike's smile widened and took on a patronizing edge, as if he were a proud father, which he had no right to do. Z says this is a small group, I said. I didn't want to be here. I needed to be home. They aren't likely to have all of Fairy attack us at our home, right?
This group wants the fire touched, he said.
So apparently my question was not what he was forbidden to discuss.
Underhill talks to people in their sleep and whispers at them when they are awake, asking for the fire touched. We've been searching for a way to make nice with her for a decade or more. We need her to survive, and she's been fickle and nasty. Some of us figure that if we give her the boy, she'll be grateful. Truthfully, others of us figure if we give her the boy, she will shut up about him, and we might be able to sleep for longer than 5 minutes at a time. It's like Chinese water torture, or that noise a car makes when your seatbelt isn't fastened.
He frowned at me, but it wasn't a directed frown.
Still, more of us aren't happy that Underhill can do that.
Do what? I asked.
Talk to us in our heads.
I nodded. The sounds from below weren't getting louder, but the frequency of the crashes was denser. Z should be finished soon. Uncle Mike bent down, picked up the unopened container of Morton salt, and handed it to me.
Here, he said. I will keep watch on your humans and secure them for you. I so swear. You two should get downstairs with the salt before Z gets really upset.
We need to release them, I said, nodding at the hostages. Get them out of here, where they will be safe. Uncle Mike shook his head.
Once Assad's circle is broken, I don't have enough magic to renew it. They are safer here. Take out the threat, then release them.
Pastor White made a wild sound and shook his head. The other man stared at me with old eyes, closed them, then opened them again. He was okay with our plan, which made me very curious about him. I met Pastor White's wild gaze. Uncle Mike doesn't lie. He'll keep you safe, has kept you safe tonight. I'm going to make sure we stop the bad guys before he lets you out of the safe zone. As we trotted down the stairs, Sherwood said,
Salt is protection against Fae?
I shook my head. Some Fae, mostly the lesser Fae, because it neutralizes magic. Uncle Mike apparently used it as a component in his spell, which Fae aren't supposed to be able to do. Salt neutralizes magic. What Uncle Mike did is the equivalent of using water to start a fire.
So don't count on it, he said as we reached the ground.
I nodded, stepped around the broken wall, and looked out into Armageddon meets Apocalypse. I'd learned some things from playing computer games with the pack. When you first enter a room, look around for your enemy was one of the golden rules of the Dread Pirate games, because the scallywags like to hide behind furniture and doorways and get you from behind. So I ignored the splintered furniture and brightly colored glass shards that littered the room and looked for the bad guys. Enemy number one was flattened beneath a pew. She was unconscious. She was breathing, but judging by the crushing injury to her back, she wasn't going to be mobile anytime soon. Enemy number two was dead. His head was a good 20 feet from his body. Not even the Fae could survive that, I didn't think. Certainly he wasn't going to get up and fight in the next 10 minutes. Enemy number three was a slender man fighting Z, both of them armed with swords. There was no enemy number four that I could sense via eyes or nose. Z fought, a wiry old man who moved like a demon. Not a wasted motion, every strike and parry clean and quicker than humanly possible. There was blood on the thin white t-shirt he wore, and some of it was his. The smaller man he fought moved oddly, though it didn't affect his control of the blade. There was something wrong with his shape and with his face. As I tried to pin it down, Z hit him and, The part of his body that Z's sword would have hit just dissolved in front of the blade, releasing little bits of sparkly light about the size and color of a yellow jacket. I finally got a clear look at his face, and he didn't have one, just a suggestion of features that moved constantly, as if all that was under his skin were the little bits that had fled the iron of Z's weapon. Some of those little bits sparkled all the way to Sherwood and me. "Ouch!" I said, slapping my forearm. Sherwood swore and started fighting with the axe. I've met a few werewolves who had lived when swords and axes were the weapons of choice for humans as well as Fae. He moved like a man born with an axe in his hand, and I don't mean to cut down trees. His axe sang a little as it cut through the air. The little hornet-like fae things dropped to the ground like miniature falling stars, some of them in two pieces. Sherwood put himself in front of me, and very few of the little vicious beasties made it through him. Skilled with an axe was our Sherwood, very skilled and very fast. His prosthetic leg hindered him occasionally, but it seemed more a matter of annoyance than a real problem, because those sparkly lights kept falling. "Couldn't fight," he'd claimed. "Couldn't fight my aching rump." I closed my fingers on the wings of one of the critters that had made it through his slicing and dicing as it bit my thigh. I had to rock it back and forth to dislodge it so I could bring it up to my face to see what it was. Up close, and without the beauty of the fluttering wings, it was utilitarian in design. Or she was. She looked vaguely like a person in shape, if not color, complete with arms and legs and miniature breasts. Her eyes were a deep purple that looked almost black against her bright yellow body. Only her mouth completely failed to mimic something human. Instead of lips, there were a pair of calicery, gory with my blood. I threw her on the ground and watched her blink out of existence the moment her body touched the fake wooden floor, the same way the bits and pieces that Sherwood was leaving behind did. I took the container of salt I'd tucked under my arm and pried open the spout. I poured a pinch into my hand and dribbled it on my wrist. The nasty bugger chewing there made a popping sound, turned gray, and fell to the ground, a dead husk. It did not disappear in a flash of light. Ha! I took a spare handful and scattered it on the fey bugs attacking Sherwood, and it sounded like popcorn cooking. I took the container and ran a gauntlet of biting fae bugs, one arm crooked above my eyes. The fae that Z fought scored a hit. It wasn't a hard hit, but Z responded by increasing the speed and fury of his attacks. I poured salt in my hand as I jumped on top of an upended pew and scattered the handful of salt on the last of our enemies. The salt landed with a crack of noise, and wherever it hit, turned gray. He turned on me. Gray powder fell on the ground, and the sparkly bugs all returned and landed on him, reabsorbed into his odd body. He raised his hands before I threw another handful, and in a voice like smoke he said, "I surrender." Z snarled, but sheathed his sword at my look. Sherwood negotiated his way through the mess of the sanctuary with a little more trouble than a man with two good legs might have, but there was nothing wrong with the speed with which he killed the woman with the crushing injury. He managed to do it before she shot the crossbow I hadn't noticed when I'd first seen her. He cleaned the axe on his pant leg, then continued to pick his way to Z and me. He looked at our prisoner.
"What are we going to do with that?" he asked.
11. We let him go. It was pretty obvious to anyone who thought about it for 2 seconds that we weren't going to be able to keep him prisoner unless Z wanted to babysit him. Ropes and duct tape don't work on someone who can dissolve into nasty insectoid thingies whenever he wants to. I especially didn't want to be around him in a car. I almost died once when my college roommate was driving a bunch of us to the movies and a hornet flew in through an open window. Once Z was sure that all of Mr. I Am Really a Hive of Female Fae Bugs was gone and there were no more fae of any size or shape hanging around downstairs, we went upstairs. All the way, Z muttered about stupid sprite lords who were weak and stupid, but not bothered as much by cold iron as most other fae.
"Cockroaches of the fae," he pronounced. "Can't hurt much, but they won't die."
Sherwood tossed his axe up in the air and caught it. I thought, by his attitude, that he was surprised at how comfortable he was with the axe. Z was still complaining about the Sprite Lord when we walked into the room with the hostages.
I thought he'd get your dander up, said Uncle Mike happily.
What do you have yourself mixed up in?
Z asked him in an exasperated tone.
Sprite Lords, you've sunk to a new low dealing with such as those.
Uncle Mike grinned.
Someone has to, Z. If they'd managed to kill these humans, they would ruin any chance of an alliance with the werewolves. They don't understand the connection between this pack and the Maroks, and I'm not inclined to enlighten them, because they are too stupid, as this situation makes quite clear. They are too likely to think about it as an opportunity instead of a danger. Alas, this brave new world that has such idiots in it.
There is no connection between our pack and the Maroks, I said. Not anymore. Uncle Mike looked at me like I was an idiot, too.
As you say, he said blandly.
Will you be in trouble for helping us? I asked. Are you going to be safe? I didn't quite offer him sanctuary. I could see the billboard now. Columbia Basin Pack welcomes disenfranchised or alienated Fae. Uncle Mike laughed, a warm belly laugh.
If fate favors me, I hope not. There's no fun in safety, is there?
He waved a hand at the salt circle, and a tickle in my throat I hadn't been paying much attention to made itself felt by going away. Then he put his foot on the ring and broke the circle. When that was done to his satisfaction, he pulled open the single large window and, after peering left and right, jumped out. I ran to the window to make sure he was okay because there was nothing to break his fall, but he was nowhere to be seen. Salt circle broken, Sherwood had wasted no time in freeing the prisoners, starting with the hands of both men. The pastor reached up as soon as his fingers were free and ripped the duct tape off his face.
How dare you, he said to me, his voice rough. This is a house of God. How dare you bring your supernatural evil into God's house?
His first instinct, as evidenced by what he'd said on the phone, had been to protect me. Apparently, he'd gotten over that. The other man took his time peeling the tape away from his mouth. Other way around, I said in as mild a tone as I could manage. Another day I'd feel bad about this, but right now I needed to make sure Pastor White and the man he'd been counseling were safe, then go find out what was happening at home. That supernatural evil brought me here. I couldn't help a bit of temper and added, I suppose I could have stayed away, and they'd probably have killed you.
Pastor, said the other man.
Married to a werewolf,
Pastor White said,
spittle leaving his mouth with his words, he was so upset. I should have asked you to leave as soon as I found out.
Pastor, said the other man again, his voice very quiet. Sherwood had freed both men's hands first and was working on the stranger's feet.
Pastor White, I think some reflection might be called for.
There was just a hint of something in his voice that made me think that he'd been called to reflect on things by the pastor once too often.
This lady just saved both of our lives, the man continued. And I think the Fae who jumped out the window cured my need for alcohol, because I swear to God that this is the first time in 20 years I haven't had the thirst. Not since that witch cursed me down in Bogota.
He looked at me.
Josh Harper, ma'am. You must be Mercy Houtman. Thank you for coming.
Bemused, I shook his hand while Pastor White continued to be very unhappy with me, the werewolves, and most everything about this church in a rant that no one listened to except for Z. That might not be healthy for Pastor White.
Fear is a hard thing, said Sherwood as he finished the last cut to free Pastor White's feet.
He patted the pastor on his knee.
You should give yourself some time to think about that.
Impelled by Sherwood's touch, the pastor surged to his feet. He opened his mouth again, looked at us, closed his mouth tightly, and made haste out of the room and down the stairs. I followed him, and I guess everyone else followed me down because we were all there when the pastor saw the chapel.
Who is going to pay for this? Pastor White whispered. We've been saving up for a new roof. It's taken us 2 years to raise half the money we need.
You should wait until the morning and call someone to board up the windows, said Z.
What happened to the bodies? Sherwood asked. Because neither the woman Sherwood had killed nor the one Z had beheaded were in the sanctuary.
Bodies? Asked Pastor White. We fade when we die, Z told Sherwood. At least most of us do. There aren't any bodies.
Look what you've done, said Pastor White.
There were tears in his eyes.
This stained glass cannot be replaced. Look at the pews.
While he took inventory of the destruction, I tried to call Adam and got a "this customer is not available" message. I tried to contact him through our mating bond, but it was being obstreperous again. I could feel him, but I couldn't contact him. We need to go, I said, and I let my actions follow my words. As we drove up to the house, the first thing that I noticed was that there were no lights, no house lights, no yard lights, nothing. It wasn't just our home. The nearest house was a 20-acre field away, and it was vacant with a for sale sign out front. I guess living next to a werewolf pack was too exciting for some people. But that didn't explain the darkness that had swallowed the rest of the homes along our road. Or Mary Jo's car pulled mostly out of the road and empty. About 100 yards beyond that, a black SUV that was a near match to Adam's down to the elegant Houtman security hand-lettered on the driver's side was parked. Adam was here. I pulled into the crowded driveway and stopped the car. No one was dead, I reassured myself. I'd felt it when Peter died. If someone else in the pack died, I'd know it. The three of us got out of the SUV and shut the doors quietly. There was a howl and a crunching noise from the back of the house. At the same time, the big glass window in the front room shattered, a dark shape hurtling through it. It smelled of rotting bog and salt and looked a little like a horse. It had 4 feet and hooves, but its head was more reptilian than equine. Its body was shaggy with fronds that made a slithery sound, like a wet hula skirt. The fidel screamed when it saw me, long yellow-white teeth flashing for a moment in the still-lit SUV headlights. I pulled out my SIG and shot the fidel in the body twice as it galloped toward us. It reared and screamed again, but not because of the bullets. Sherwood threw the axe and hit it in the head. The axe dislodged from the fidel's head and slid down to his shoulder before it bounced off to the grass. The touch of iron left a brown gap in the plant-like hair from the top of the fidel's neck and down his chest. Z hopped onto the hood of the nearest car, ran to the top, and launched himself into the air, his sword raised. He seemed to linger in the air, but that couldn't have been true, because his sword flashed down on the fidel before Sherwood could pick up the axe. The fidel shifted to human shape, a sword in his left hand that met Z's black blade with a noise fit to wake the dead. Sparks flew like fireflies and disappeared into the darkness. It wasn't magic, I don't think, just a bit of physics. I heard Jesse scream and the distinctive crack of my .44 Marlin rifle as it fired 4 times in succession. A moment later, there was a flash of fire I could see clearly through the broken window. I left the fidel for Z and Sherwood and bolted up the porch stairs. The front door was unlocked, and I opened it with a bang. Jesse was on the second floor at the top of the stairway, the rifle ready to fire. Cookie was pressed against her leg, growling ferociously. Their attention was focused toward the living room.
"Stay down there," she said. "I won't let you have him."
Something the size of a car boiled out of the living room. My eyes didn't want to focus on it because it was so ugly or beautiful. It had a lot of insectoid legs and some sort of flowing, luminous blue-green carapace that moved like silk blown in the wind. But when Jesse shot the Fae again, the bullet ricocheted off the carapace, hitting the wall 2 feet from my head.
"Stop firing!"
I shouted and raised my SIG. I dropped to one knee on the ground, aiming under the carapace at an angle that wouldn't allow me to bounce a bullet up to the top of the stairs. I emptied the gun into the Fae, and blue-green blood sprayed onto the white carpet. That was good, because some of the Fae can't be hurt with lead bullets. The Fae creature whirled on me in a snake-like motion. I got a confusing glimpse of a beautiful woman's face with skin of amber and eyes of ruby.
I surged to my feet, running toward her, even though I was weaponless. Running away would only have caused her to charge me. As it was, she hesitated, doubtless reasoning that if I was running toward her, I must have some sort of an attack in mind. I tripped on the walking stick and rolled with the fall. I used the momentum to power my thrust, and the walking stick's sharp spearhead slid into the Amber Fae's mouth. It wasn't exactly unexpected that the walking stick would show up, but I hadn't counted on it. I'd been planning on running past the Fae creature and luring it away from the kids to the backyard, where I could hear a battle raging. The Fae creature dropped to the ground, the light fading from its carapace. I held the walking stick at the ready, but the Fae stayed where she was, not breathing. Aiden, appearing beside Jesse at the top of the stairs, made a motion with his hand, and the Amber Fae's body began to burn with a smoldering, angry blue flame. There was a cracking boom from the kitchen that sounded like a door being ripped from its hinges. Then the Tibisena, a great gash opened on his hip from which molten rock dripped, bolted into the foyer and closed his great jaws on the Amber Fae's face. This time the Tibisena was built like a wolf rather than the foo dog of his last appearance. Upright ears topped a muzzle that was long and narrow. His body was finer bone than a werewolf of his size would have been, more like a wolf's gracile and narrow form. His tail was covered with molten hair, and it curled a little. He jerked his head, and there was a snapping sound before the Fae's amber face melted like wax in his teeth. Between Aiden's sullen blue fire and the Tibisena's red flame and black teeth, the Fae was definitely dead. Aiden closed his fist and spoke a word of power that emitted a sharp magical smell that made me sneeze. His fire died to nothing as the last of the Fae's body turned to ash. Aiden slipped past Jesse and trotted down the stairs. Hoel snarled at him, then at me when I moved. I froze, but Aiden kept coming.
"It's done, it is," Aiden told Hoel. "That was the last of them. Can you hear the silence? It's the good kind of silence, not the silence that listens back. Hear the silence and feel the air. There is only death that visited our enemies and the blood of our wounded. No more battle. No more enemies to kill. Time to sleep, Fire Dog," he said, and touched his hand to Hoel's forehead.
Hoel took a deep breath and turned his head to lick Aiden's hand twice before settling on the floor in the ashes of the Amber Fae. A few breaths later, Hoel's naked human form lay in the Tibisena's place. He sat up, and Cookie bounded down the stairs and licked his face anxiously. Hoel began laughing. He looked up at Aiden and said,
"Thanks, Miho. That was the first time I've ever let the Tibisena free, because I knew you'd be there. That was fun."
His voice slurred a little, as if he were drunk. Rapid footsteps from the direction of the kitchen had me gripping the walking stick, which was, once more, a stick. But it was only Mary Jo, armed with a pickaxe that was covered with various substances that might be Fae blood. She skidded to a stop, her hand half raised.
"Which one was that?" she asked, gesturing at the ashes.
"Glowed blue," I told her, "with a face that looked like it had been carved in amber."
"Caterpillar girl," said Mary Jo. "That only leaves Water Horse."
The front door opened, and Z and Sherwood ran in, weapons in hand.
"Water Horse was the Fidel," I told her.
I looked at Z.
"Did you kill him?"
Z relaxed and made a quick movement that my eyes didn't quite follow, but after which his sword was gone.
"I warned him not to come back," said Z, and he glanced at Sherwood. "I've seen you fight before. What did you say your name was?"
Sherwood gave him a half smile.
"Sherwood Post."
Z blinked at him.
"That sounds like a fence built by Robin Hood."
"Don't ever forget your name when Bran is around," I told Z. "I figure Sherwood got away lightly. Just think if Bran had been reading Moby Dick and The Old Man and the Sea instead. Sherwood could have been Herman Hemingway."
"Or what if he'd been reading Louis L'Amour?" asked Mary Jo. "Sherwood L'Amour would have doomed you to stripper jokes for the rest of your life."
Z frowned.
"If I've seen you fight, and I have long ago, somewhere, it may take some time to come to me. But if I've seen you fight, it's a fair and sure thing that Bran knows who you are. There aren't that many old wolves running around, and none that the old bastard doesn't know.
I opened my mouth to say something, and shut it because it would have been bitter. Bran had made the decision to cut us loose based on what he thought would be best for the werewolves. It was no use being bitter at Bran for acting like himself.
Mercy,
Adam said. I hadn't heard him approach. I turned just in time to be enveloped in warm arms that closed just a little too hard. He smelled of blood, his own and others, but I was reassured by the strength of his embrace. I just stood there for a moment and breathed him in.
So I see you made it here alive,
he said after a moment. You too, I said. Congratulations. I might have been shaking a little. Now that it was all over, that we'd all survived, even poor Pastor White, and we'd kept them from taking Aiden, now I could shake. When I felt the weight of eyes on my back, I took a deep breath and stepped back. How did we do? I asked.
Paul's hurt the worst, Adam told me. Mary Jo brought Carlos with her, and he's doing wound care out in the backyard. Paul will feel it for a few days, but he'll be fine. Ben got messed up pretty badly, too. He and Paul were on the front lines on their own for about 5 minutes before Mary Jo and her band of merry wolves got here.
I'm sorry, said Aiden, his voice solemn.
Yes, you are, said Jessie stoutly.
She'd come down the stairs while I wasn't looking.
But that doesn't mean that they can come here and feed you to a monster on our watch.
She patted him on the head.
And while I'm at it, thanks, Squirt, for saving my life.
She looked at her dad.
They came out of the river. Ben was the first one to notice them. We were stargazing in the backyard. He yelled at us to get in the house, to get to the safe room.
She frowned.
We should have, but there were a bunch of those things, and only Paul and Ben to fight them. So we ran up to your bedroom, and I grabbed the .444 and ran to the sitting room and started shooting. You're going to have to get that window replaced.
There are a lot of windows that need replaced, I said.
The back wall of the house needs to be replaced, said Mary Jo. One of them had some sort of earth magic. She took the huge rocks that Christy had placed around the backyard as decor and hurled them. A couple of them hit the house.
I think I killed her, said Jessie, suddenly sounding younger. I tried to anyway. She threw that granite boulder and hit Paul with it.
That's about when I arrived, Mary Jo said. Ben's pretty proud of you, kid. You hit her right between the eyes. You are the reason that Paul and Ben aren't dead, and if the Fae had taken those two out that early, I'd have shown up too late.
Adam started to put a hand on Jessie, and I caught his eye and shook my head. She was holding on, just barely. If he hugged her, she'd lose it, and she deserved better than that. Jessie caught his hand and gripped it tightly, giving me a smile.
Anyway, one of them climbed up the side of the house, and bullets didn't do anything to him. He got through the window in the sitting room, and Aiden touched him.
She swallowed.
I'm not actually sure he's dead. We got out of there and shut the door. There was a lot of noise by that time, and the blue silky caterpillar lady was downstairs, so Aiden and I crouched in the hallway and waited.
Mary Jo said something under her breath, dodged into the kitchen, and grabbed the fire extinguisher from the counter. We now had a lot of fire extinguishers stashed around the house, and ran up the stairs.
If the house were going to have caught fire, Jessie said, I think it would have done so by now.
Reflexes, I told her. Remember, Mary Jo fights fires for a living, and Aiden has been doing his best to refine her response time.
It's okay, Mary Jo called down after a moment, but you're going to have to replace some furniture and the carpets in the sitting room.
Mary Jo had been right. The back of the house was going to need major repairs. The yard was a real mess. Christie's careful landscaping had been ruined. 4 of the 5 giant boulders were scattered at random to the detriment of lawn furniture and trees and garden spots. The 5th boulder was in the middle of the kitchen floor. There was now no question that we'd have to retile the kitchen. The big window in the living room was shattered, as were, as far as I could tell, all but one of the windows in the back. Werewolves trickled in as word spread to those not actively involved in the actual battle, and they came over to help with cleanup. Someone rustled up tuna fish sandwiches, and the night took on the oddly festive air of a work party.
When they were done, the yard didn't look pristine, but it was neat. Paving stones were stacked in piles. Things broken beyond repair, like the cement benches and a lot of garbage bags from the house, were set aside for the next garbage run. We did the best we could with the inside of the house, mostly sweeping or vacuuming up glass and throwing away broken things. Ben and Mary Jo brought out plywood sheets from the garage, and I helped put them in place over the windows. Windows are fragile, and werewolves are not. Putting up plywood wasn't a skill I would have actively sought out on my own, but I was pretty good at it. We were 4 sheets short of getting the job done, so we left the front window open until someone could get to a hardware store in the morning. Adam came over when we were getting the last one up.
"Ben," he said, "Arielle and Daryl are headed home. You can ride in with them."
Ben's truck had gotten smashed in the battle between Z, Sherwood, and the Fidel. I told him that he'd be better off taking a settlement from his insurance and buying a new truck rather than repairing the old one. Once the frame was bent, it wasn't usually worth the trouble of fixing it. Ben stepped back from the job and stretched. He had a long cut the length of his face from the tip of his eye, down his jaw, and onto his collarbone. It had mostly healed up, and he looked as though he'd been in a car wreck several days earlier.
"My croaking fat frog will shag my fucking Aunt Fanny before I'll go now," he said. "Until we get matters straightened out with the Fae, I'm living right the fucking hell here."
And as if in answer, the lights all over the world, or at least our part of the world, turned on as the power company figured out how to fix whatever the Fae had done. Ben took a bow and accepted the applause of the pack. We spent the next couple of days repairing what we could and carting away what we couldn't. Adam's contractor friend was optimistic that the stucco on the front of the house could be saved. Adam and I were repairing a planting bed crushed by the granite boulder when it landed on Paul, who was mostly back on his feet now. We were discussing the merits of a rosebush in place of the dogwood, which was not as tough as Paul and had suffered unrecoverable damage, when the house phone rang.
"I've got it,"
called Jessie. I heard her voice as she answered the phone, but didn't catch what she said. Then she called brightly,
"Hey, Dad, Baba Yaga is on the phone for you."
I followed him into the kitchen where Jessie stood with a handset. She gave it to him. Then she looked at me and raised her eyebrows in an exaggerated fashion that made her eyes bulge and mouthed, "Baba Yaga, really?" I nodded and mouthed, "Really." She hugged herself, and as she passed by me on her way out of the room, she whispered,
"Now how many people have gotten to say that? Hey, Dad, Baba Yaga is on the phone for you."
Aiden was coming in as she was going out. Fighting together seemed to have broken the Cold War and initiated a detente between Jessie and Aiden. Her tone was relaxed as she said,
"Hey, short stuff, offended anyone bigger than you lately?"
"Everyone is bigger than me, Daisy Duke," he said.
His attempt at teasing was lame, but he was making an effort. Last night, the werewolves had run a Dukes of Hazzard marathon in Aiden's honor. The whole pack were trying their best to help him climb into the modern era with the help of TV shows and movies. It might have been more effective if they'd chosen something filmed in this decade, but their hearts were in the right place. I hope that Aiden didn't think that cars really could jump rivers and barns and whatever. He seemed to know that he'd gotten it wrong with the Daisy, but he cleared his throat and tried again.
"Bigger is easy. Finding someone smaller to offend is a real challenge."
"I'm sure you're up for that, too," Jessie said, teasing him back. "You show some real aptitude in that area."
He grinned at her, but then he turned his attention to me.
"The witch is calling for a meeting with the Fae, right?"
Jessie paused, and they both looked at me. "That's what it sounds like," I agreed.
"You need to take me to this meeting," he said. "Z says that Underhill won't leave them alone. They can't afford for me to escape."
"We're not giving you to them," I told him.
"Excuse me," said Adam.
He covered the mouthpiece, looked Aiden in the eyes, and said,
"You stay here. No question."
Aiden opened his mouth to argue, but Adam stared him down. Only when Aiden dropped his eyes did Adam go back to his call. We agreed to meet at Uncle Mike's.
It was as close as we could come to neutral territory. The once bar was in East Pasco near the river, on the edge of the industrial district. The bar had been shut down for more than half a year. I expected it to smell musty or unused, but when Uncle Mike opened the door, his face somber, it smelled exactly the way it always did. Alcohol, sawdust, peanuts, and the scents of hundreds of individuals. The last were faded and mixed into a musk from which it would have been impossible to coax a single thread free. And it smelled of magic. When it had been open, the light had been kept low. But all the lights were on, and it was nearly as bright as it would have been had there been windows. Most of the tables were stacked in a pyramid in one corner of the room, large tables on the bottom, smaller on top. The chairs were mostly stacked, too, awaiting the day when the bar reopened. One of the big tables had been set in the middle of the mostly empty room, and chairs were set around it.
"The others are here," said Uncle Mike. "In the back. I'll get them."
He left us, Adam and me, alone in the room. The rest of the pack, all of them, were at our house protecting Aiden and Jesse. Daryl hadn't been happy that we weren't taking any extra wolves with us. But the Fae had no reason to kill us, and the pack could protect Aiden and keep him safe. Or else, I'd been happy to point out to Daryl, nothing we could do would keep anyone safe at all. Uncle Mike returned, escorting Beauclair and the bald man whom Margaret had forced to her will. Garau. The discrepancy between what I would have expected from a knight of the round table, fictional though it was, and Garau, left me bitterly and irrationally disappointed. They brought the good fairy and the bad fairy. I looked at Beauclair and frowned at him. He looked cool and composed, as he had every time I'd seen him. Maybe we were meeting the bad fairy and the worse fairy. I had expected to be facing more. We apparently weren't, Adam and I, as important as Margaret. I might have been offended, except the fewer Grey Lords we sat down with, the more likely we would be to walk away alive. We all went to the scarred table and sat down virtually at the same time. Adam was slower because he held my chair out.
"Are there any other Fae in the building or adjacent lot?" asked Adam as he settled. "No," said Uncle Mike. "Just the three of us, and I don't count." "What do you want?" asked Adam.
"There are 9 Fae dead," said Beauclair very softly.
"Yep," I thought, my stomach clenched. "Bad fairy and worse fairy."
"They attacked us," Adam told them. "That makes their deaths their own fault."
"Point," agreed Beauclair, and he glanced at Garau.
"They were on their own," he told us. "As I understand, Uncle Mike informed you." "How often," said Adam dangerously, "are we going to be discussing how many of your people have been killed by their own stupidity before you stop them instead of making me do it?"
"We have discussed this very thing," said Beauclair grimly.
Garau pushed back his chair and sighed.
"As well as a whole rotting cesspool of other things."
He sat in silence a moment, examining Adam without meeting his eyes and avoiding any kind of dominance game. Finally, he leaned forward, and it was as if he peeled off a glamour without changing his form at all. When he spoke, his voice was still tenor, but it had softened and lost the squeak. Instead of a parody, he became someone who might once have ridden beside Arthur.
"Some old king," Garau said, "some old time or other proclaimed that if the Welsh had all started fighting one enemy instead of each other, they would have conquered the world. That goes double for the Fae. Still, we did passably well for the past couple of 100 years, protecting the weak and reigning in the strong and vicious."
He flashed a humorless smile.
"Coexisting, you could call it. Then Underhill opened unexpectedly. On one of the reservations, then on all of the reservations, thousands if not tens of thousands of miles from the nearest old door."
"Unexpected by some," murmured Beauclair.
Garau nodded gravely at Beauclair.
"You were behind the drive to create the reservations. I followed your lead because it made sense to have a place of safety to keep those who were too frightening or too frightened. I don't know 5 Fae who thought that you'd be right about Underhill, that she would follow us."
He He looked at Adam again.
While we were still debating what should change, what could change, this one killed a human for the sake of justice.
There was a capital letter starting that word. I could hear it in his voice.
And then he issued a recall, and all of us were penned up in the reservations.
He pinched his nose and gave Beauclair a pained look.
There were probably less eventful ways to handle it.
Beauclair pursed his lips.
Are you sure that we should spill our secrets here?
Garau smiled, a smile as sweet and innocent as sunshine.
And what do you think they will do with our secrets, this warrior and his soft-hearted coyote mate? If our side in this battle prevails, it won't matter. If not, well then, we'll probably be fighting on their side anyway.
Beauclair gave a reluctant nod.
Point.
Garau's smile widened a little, then died. When he spoke again, it was to us.
Afterward, we thought for a while that we could stay on our reservations. No humans could get in, not with their fighter jets or tanks. A bard might have managed, but your bards are not given to wandering in the wilderness in this era. We had, after all, Underhill to live in. Underhill exists in a different space and time. Infinite space.
He and Beauclair exchanged a glance. Beauclair snorted abruptly and threw up his hands.
Why not, he said, and it was Beauclair who continued. But Underhill is different. I will spare you the dozens of explanations we've thrown at her and had thrown back. No one knows why. She's volatile, unpredictable. We lost 4 Selkies on one of the other reservations. They apparently had found a doorway.
Here he paused and said,
A doorway is not, strictly speaking, a doorway as you would think of it, though it can be. Some of the doors to Underhill are invisible and impossible to detect unless you happen to stumble through one.
He sighed, which didn't bode well for the 4 Selkies, I thought.
They found a place where there was a big salt lake, cold and clear, a 5th Selkie told me, that they could see to the bottom of, though it was 100 feet down. They disappeared for a couple of weeks, which would not normally have been a concern because time can pass differently in Underhill. But the 5th Selkie had gone to the Salt Lake and couldn't find them. We searched and asked Underhill, who quit talking to us for a couple of days. Then the 5th Selkie found the skeletons of the 4 Selkies laid out on the sands of their lake.
A predator? I asked.
Selkies are tough, said Garau. And there were no teeth marks on the bones.
There are some of us who are very old, Beauclair said. Baba Yaga is one of those. She remembers a time when Underhill killed as many Fae as traveled through her, a time when Underhill was very young. She told us that Underhill mellowed with time, 500 or 600 years.
So you couldn't stay on the reservations, said Adam. There are too many of you for the land you have if you can't trust Underhill to be a home.
Garau nodded.
So we were going to have to resume living in the humans' world, but we would do it on our own terms. We had quite a lively discussion on the matter, said Uncle Mike with an unrepentant grin. Not that I was a participant, mind you, but some things should be witnessed.
Both of the other Fae gave him an unamused look that bothered Uncle Mike not at all.
I have some very nice hard cider in the back room, he said. Would anyone care for some?
Garau gave him a sharp look.
I like humans, Uncle Mike said seriously. I might be the only Fae alive today who can say that and not mean as a meal. I want them to survive. I want to survive. I'm on your side. Cider would be good, said Adam. This sounds like it will take a while. And though we are intrigued with the story, I'm not sure why you are telling it to us.
I want you to understand that our options are limited, said Garau. I want you to really, really understand why we find ourselves here in this place at this time. If we, and by we, I mean the Fae, the werewolves, the humans, and anyone else who wants to live a full life, are to find our way out of it, then we, Beauclair and I, need your help.
Uncle Mike excused himself. And we waited quietly while he made glass clinky and cider-getting noises behind the closed doors marked employees only in bright green letters. He brought back a tray with 5 clear frosty mugs
and a glass pitcher filled with a golden liquid that bubbled and sparkled like champagne. I generally don't drink alcohol. I have too many people's secrets in my head, and alcohol affects me oddly. But to refuse it in this place and time was more of a statement than I wanted to make.